From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Richard Powers about his award-winning novel, The Echo Maker, which explores the mysteries of human consciousness and identity. A 27-year-old man is in a car accident and emerges from his coma with a rare neurological disorder. He can recall almost everything about his life, but he believes his family members and closest friends are imposters. The book is now out in paperback. Also, the 1991 documentary Hearts of Darkness, about the making of Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now, finally is out on DVD. We hear from Eleanor Coppola, Francis's wife, who provided footage for Hearts of Darkness. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Juno, directed by Jason Reitman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest Richard Powers won the National Book Award for Fiction last year for his novel The Echo Maker. It's now out in paperback. Powers is a former MacArthur Fellow. Before he started writing books, he studied science, and his knowledge of science, medicine, and computers is apparent in his novels, like The Goldbug Variations, Operation Wandering Soul, and Galatea 2.2. The Echo Maker is about the mysteries of consciousness and identity and draws on the discoveries of neuroscience. As the book opens, a 27-year-old man is lying in a coma after surviving a car accident, and his sister is on her way to see him in the hospital. She watches over him as he emerges from the coma and slowly seems to become more like his old self. But something has gone wrong in his brain. He thinks his sister really is an imposter. Terry spoke with Richard Powers last December.
I'd like you to start with a reading from your new book, The Echo Maker. Would you just set it up for us?
In this passage, Karen Schluter, who has returned to the hometown that she spent her life trying to escape, is nursing her brother back from a very severe car accident. And he has come back part of the way from a full coma. But as she discovers in this passage and continues to discover, he's not coming back quite as the brother that he was before the accident. So this passage is focalized through Karen. He talked more than he had before the accident. He swung from bouts of rage into a sweetness he'd lost at the age of 8. She told him the doctors wanted to move him out of the hospital. Mark glowed. He thought he was going home. "Can you tell my sister I've got the green light? Tell her Mark Schluter's out of here. Whatever's been holding her up, she'll know where to find me." She bit her lip and refused even to nod. She'd read in one of Daniel's neurology books never to humor delusions. "She'll be worried about me. Man, you have to promise me. Wherever she's gone, she needs to know what's happening. She was, like, always looking after me. That's her big thing. Personal claim to fame. Saved my life once. My father came this close to snapping my neck like a pencil. I'll tell you about it someday. Personal stuff. But trust me, I'd be dead without my sister." It tore her up to look on and say nothing. And yet, she felt a sick fascination at the chance to learn what Mark really said about her when talking to someone else. She could survive this, for however long it took him to come back to reason. And his reason was solidifying daily. "Maybe they're keeping her away from me. Why won't they let me talk to her? Am I somebody's science project? They want to see if I'll mistake you for her?" He saw her distress, but mistook it for indignation. "Hey, okay, you've helped me too in your own way. You're here every day, walking, reading, whatever. I don't know what you want, but I'm the grateful recipe." "Recipient," she said. He stared at her, baffled. "You said recipe. You mean recipient?" He scowled. "I was using the singular. You look a lot like her, you know. Maybe not quite as pretty, but damn close."
That's Richard Powers reading an excerpt of his novel, The Echo Maker. Richard, tell us a little bit about the neurological disorder that's responsible for the character, you know, for the brother not being able to recognize his sister and thinking that she's impersonating his sister.
The disorder is called Capgras syndrome. It's one of a family of misidentification syndromes. And in Capgras, the sufferer looks upon people close to him as somehow substitutions. And the disorder is remarkable because it's very selective. The sufferer has no problems with neighbors or colleagues or even friends. But those people who he's most intimate with emotionally, those people he loves, he refuses to accept. He says, "They look like my family, they sound like my family, they act like my family, But they're imposters. They've been substituted. They're government agents or they're aliens.
Is there any neurological explanation for why this syndrome only affects people who you're very close to?
The prevailing suggestion is that when we make a recognition, there are at least three regions of the brain that are involved. And one does the actual pattern matching, color of hair, width of eyes, length of face. And this is extremely precise. We have very specialized circuits in place for recognizing faces. Of course, there's the portion of the brain that's responsible for memory association. So once you make a face recognition, there's a whole slew of memory traces and associations that are released by that face. And in a Capgras sufferer, both of those are intact, and they're both still speaking to each other, both of those regions. What's missing is what the rest of us still have, namely a very low-level area of the brain called the amygdala, which is responsible for deep-seated emotions, you know, very primal hope and fear. And in the Capgras sufferer, this simply isn't somehow in triggered or in communication with these other two areas when a facial recognition is made. So in a sense, the sufferer looks at someone and says, this looks like my sister, dresses like my sister, sounds like my sister, acts like my sister. It just doesn't feel like my sister.
You know, in reading your book and in reading about this rare neurological disorder in which you believe that your loved ones are really imposters, it made me think about movies like Invasion of the Body Snatchers and Invaders from Mars. Now, in those movies, the people really are imposters. Science fiction films with like elaborate metaphors within them. But I was wondering if you were thinking about that too. How this seems to be an almost like archetypical fear.
In fact, the neurologists and neuroscientists who write about Capgras often mention those kinds of narratives, those films. And I guess it is a deep-seated fear. And I think it's because even those of us who haven't experienced full-fledged Capgras, either as a sufferer or as a witness to one, must somehow sense that capacity, that decoupling of intellectual recognition and emotional recognition, is in us. And in fact, Capgras may just be an extreme case of the kinds of things that any one of us could experience in a temporary or attenuated way. And the most obvious example is, you know, who of us hasn't sworn undying love for someone and incredibly intimate and profound self-shaking connection to a loved one, and then after some passage of time and change in events say, no, actually I was wrong. I don't feel connected to that person at all. And we're all completely capable of re-narrating ourselves.
And what you say in that situation is, you're not the person I once knew. You're not the person I fell in love with. You're not
something
my real
happened.
Mother. Yeah, or whatever.
Something happened to you.
Something happened to you, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And we change our story. Well, you know, it's the self is an incredibly ingenious novelist and is constantly revising its sense of continuity and wholeness.
What you just said about the self being a novelist, I imagine this is one of the reasons why, as a novelist, you're interested in exploring this neurological disorder, because it changes the sense of self and your idea of the people around you. And of course, as a novelist, you're creating selves, lots of them.
That's right. That's right. It was almost inevitable, I think, that I would want to write about these disorders and the deep neurology of narrative at some point. This book is, in some ways, I conceived of it as a neurological mystery story, which in some ways might almost be a redundancy, right? That the brain itself is a kind of mystery story. But the link, of course, is that the processes in the brain are held together by narrative. We report to ourselves, you know, when we think about our identity, who we are, we present ourselves to ourselves as continuous and stable and whole and The same person we were 10 years ago, and completely understandable in a kind of Aristotelian, you know, sense of wholeness, and that our lives have a comprehensible beginning, middle, and end, and it's all very clean. And in fact, the self is just a kind of late day addition to this incredibly noisy parliament of hundreds of parts in the brain, and it's only by very fancy footwork and an insistence on narrative logic that we can hold together these, you know, two or 300 parts and present it to the world as a solid and a single thing.
Now, there's a neurologist in your book who investigates this case and examines the character of Mark. And this is a doctor who seems to be inspired by Dr. Oliver Sacks, the famous neurologist who has written many books of case studies, the case studies of his own patients. It sounds like you want to interrupt me here.
Well, I was just going to say, for purposes of legal protection, I should probably say...
I knew you were going to say that, right.
that Dr. Weber's work in the book probably very closely resembles the kind of work that Sacks does. But as a human being, of course, he draws nothing on the life of Sacks. In fact, the work of the neurologist Gerald Weber in the book is a real composite of 10 or 11 different neurologists, all of whom have done amazing and incredibly fascinating work in documenting neuropsychology over the last 20 or 30 years, all the ways that the brain can go wrong. And of course, for somebody who's devoted his life to really looking under the hood and seeing what can happen down there in this noisy kind of seething network of parts, the self can become very unstable just by virtue of the intellectual knowledge of how unreliable the self is.
Yeah, he says, I like this phrase a lot. You have him say that this case is a chance to see just how treacherous the logic of consciousness was.
Mm, yeah, the old unreliable first-person narrator again. What happens, I guess, in the story is that... because Mark has been so radically transformed, but can't see that it's he that's different and not the world. His sister has to come and take care of him and be near him and attempt to fulfill her sense of self, which is as the good sister to the bad brother. But the problem for Karen, of course, is that her sense of self depends upon being ratified by her brother in this role that she's given herself, the protector, the caretaker. So when Mark comes out of his disastrous close-head trauma and says, you're not my sister, Karen has to ask herself the question, well, then who am I?
Richard Powers speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with author Richard Powers. His novel, The Echo Maker, which won the National Book Award for Fiction, is now out in paperback. It's about a young man who emerges from a coma with a rare neurological disorder. He thinks the people closest to him really are imposters.
Now, I've read that you've been using computers since the 1970s, since like the mid-70s, is that about right? Earlier than
That's
that?
Right. Okay. Maybe a little earlier. I got my first personal computer in 77. So that was about the time when they were really first appearing as commercially available products.
And you've written computer-related themes in your fiction. But on the other hand, like this new book, apparently instead of sitting at a computer and typing the words onto the page, you used voice recognition software so you could speak the words onto
that's right.
into the computer. And I found that kind of interesting. I don't know, speaking for myself, not that I'm a writer, but I do have to write things, but I find like it almost uses a different part of my brain to write than to speak. And I'm not sure that that's a bad thing, because there's a certain carefulness you want in your writing that is impossible to get in your speaking. You feel like if somebody's reading you, that you owe them, you know what I mean? You owe them a more careful and considered and perfected language. That is, I think, probably easier to get in a writing kind of mode. And I really wanted to hear your thoughts about that.
Yeah. Well, you've put your finger on it. Typing and speaking are two completely different neurological activities. Both are very complicated. Both are going to invoke, each one is going to invoke very different combinations of regions of the brain. And we put tremendous amount of effort into learning how to type and learning how to compose and type at the same time. It's, however, a highly artificial interface and extremely unnatural. You know, it's a little bit like a dog walking on its hind legs. And there are many things that you can't do when composing and typing at the same time. If you've ever tried to talk to somebody who's typing, you can see just how fully engaging the act of pressing out one letter at a time on a keyboard is. The great advantage of speaking over typing is it puts me in touch with longer phrases. It allows me to think in terms of the music of the prose. I'm not constantly interrupting my memory to change from inventing a clause and then keying it in letter by letter, which is the exact opposite of sense and sound. Rather, I can hear my character speak. I can hear the rhythm and the meaning of the passage that I'm working on. I can flow more smoothly directly from memory to composition. And, of course, I can always go back and edit and do the kind of careful massaging that you're talking about. The first spoken draft is just the beginning.
You know, in your novel, you're using this neurological disorder to help you explore the question, what gives us our sense of self? And what are some of the ways that that can go wrong? When you were 11, your family moved to Bangkok, Thailand, because your father became the principal of the International School of Bangkok. How did it change your sense of self when, as an 11-year-old, when your sense of self is still being formed, you were suddenly in a country in a very different part of the world?
Yeah, I think on that, and I think that really was the transforming event in my life. At 11, you know, the brain is so plastic still. You know, before puberty, we moved to Bangkok, and within 6 months, I was speaking Thai just from being out on the street. You know, not without any formal study. You know, when you have a new immersive experience when you're young, you're completely capable, you know, chameleon-like of just changing and taking on this alter ego. The real culture shock for me happened when I came back to the United States at 16. You know, I thought I knew this place, and I thought it was my country and my culture. And in fact, those years away, being in another country, you know, speaking another language and living a very different kind of life, made it a weirdly estranging experience. You know, the talk about misidentification syndromes. You know, here I was back in the Midwest, back in suburban Chicago, and simultaneously recognizing my native country and feeling very much estranged and outside it. And I think that's the kind of prototype experience that creates the narrative imagination, when you're both in your life and sitting on your own shoulder looking at it as if you were an outsider. That kind of double existence, I think, really was instrumental in me in setting up a kind of sensibility that was invaluable later on in telling stories.
You know, that sense that you were describing of, like, living life, but also kind of sitting on your shoulder watching yourself live your life. It's kind of like the writer's position in some ways, because you're doing it and then you're standing back and observing and reporting to yourself on what it is. What is
absolutely
you've done.
The writer's position.
Yeah. So okay, it's the writer's position, but it's not a very comfortable position when you're not writing, I don't think. I mean, how do you like that feeling of standing outside yourself and watching yourself?
Well, you know, it's interesting because in a way. That's the condition that I try to create in Dr. Weber in the book. He simultaneously...
This is the neurologist.
That's right, the neurologist who's been called in to study Mark. His wife, for instance, teases him. He has become well-known as a popularizer of neuropsychology, and she refers to the role that he plays in public as Famous Gerald. And so Weber is simultaneously... doing his science and doing his writing, but aware of the degree to which he is performing this other person. And you're absolutely right. When you can't do that, when you can't somehow move back and forth from the world of experience to the world of imagination and the world of representation, a sense of vertigo and disorientation does result, which is why I think you scratch a writer and you're going to find the compulsive inventor and someone who if he or she isn't writing for a couple of days is bound to descend pretty quickly into erratic behavior.
Well, Richard Powers, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Richard Powers speaking to Terry Gross last December. His novel, The Echo Maker, which won the National Book Award for Fiction, is now out in paperback. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to rebuild fisheries and preserve the coastal communities of the United States, at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, behind the scenes of Apocalypse Now, we'll talk with Eleanor Coppola, the wife of Francis Ford Coppola. Her documentary, Hearts of Darkness, is about the making of the epic Vietnam War film. It's now out on DVD. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Juno, directed by Jason Reitman, whose last film was Thank You for Smoking. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. First, there was Apocalypse Now, the Francis Ford Coppola Vietnam film that took years to make and was infamous for its problems with money, logistics, stars, and the lack of a workable shooting script. Coppola began filming in 1976, inspired by Joseph Conrad's novel Heart of Darkness, and unveiled it 3 years later, years in which he replaced original lead Harvey Keitel with Martin Sheen, had to shoot around an overweight and uncooperative Marlon Brando, and deal with heart attacks, drug use, and the risk of the loss of his own money to complete the film. When all the napalm smoke cleared, Apocalypse Now was declared a masterpiece. Next came Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse, a behind-the-scenes look at the frenzied making of Apocalypse Now. It didn't come out until 1991 as a documentary on Showtime, and it vanished a year later until now. That documentary, written by Fax Barr and George Hickenlooper, finally has been released on DVD. The 1991 production featured new interviews with the cast and crew, reflecting on the insanity of the making of the film. Terry also interviewed some of the film's participants, including Walter Murch, who won an Academy Award for sound design.
The film is just under 2.5 hours long, and there were just under 250 hours of material.
Wow.
So it's roughly 100 hours of material for every hour that made it on the screen. So it's actually amazing that we finished it as quickly as we did.
Terry also spoke with star Martin Sheen, who talks about the movie's intense opening scene, and later about suffering a heart attack during filming. At the time, he was 36 years old.
I had been drinking all of that day, and I was quite inebriated by the time we got to filming that scene. And I asked Francis to allow me to wrestle, in a sense, with some demons that were inside of me that I was wrestling with, to get them out in the open, to wrestle with them in public, to wrestle with them on film. And he was very reluctant, and particularly when I hurt myself in the middle of the scene, he tried to stop it. I slammed my hand into a mirror, which I didn't even know was there. And he had two cameras going, and I begged him not to stop. A lot of my pain came to the surface. There was no defense left. And you saw, really, in a sense, who I was at that time. I was a very confused man, very unhappy man. And I came to grips with it there.
In Hearts of Darkness, the most amazing footage is material that was shot at the time, and shot, even more amazingly, by Coppola's wife, Eleanor. She gets more up close and personal than any other behind-the-scenes filmmaker could have, especially when interviewing her husband.
What I have to admit is that I don't know what I'm doing.
How do you account for the discrepancy between what you feel about it and what everybody else who sees it or the other?
Because they see the magic of what has happened before. I'm saying, hey, it's not gonna happen. I don't have any performances. The script doesn't make sense. I have no ending. I'm like a voice crying out, saying, please, it's not working. Somebody get me off this. And nobody listens to me. Everyone says, yes, well, Francis works best in a crisis. I'm saying, this is one crisis I'm not gonna pull myself out of. I'm making a bad movie, so why should I go ahead? I'm gonna be bankrupt anyway. Why can't I just have the courage to say it's no good?
Francis Coppola's Apocalypse Now was very good, and so is Hearts of Darkness, using footage filmed by Eleanor Coppola. Terry spoke with Eleanor Coppola in 1992, when the documentary was released theatrically after its premiere on cable. During the filming of Apocalypse Now, Francis Coppola staged spectacular recreations of the American bombing of Vietnam. Terry asked Eleanor Coppola what it felt like to be in the middle of a phony war.
Well, I found it really exhilarating. You know, it's like the most incredible 4th of July kind of a light show with these, you know, enormous explosions, and the earth shook like an earthquake. They were huge, particularly the napalm attack, and the scene with Colonel Kilgore, Robert Duvall, was just a powerful event to be there. It was just, your whole body felt the concussion and this enormous, you know, whatever it was, 10,000 gallons of fuel was lit and exploded in the jungle. And I really found it extraordinary. And I think sometimes that even annoyed Francis, that he was trying to get his work done and everybody else was kind of at a light show.
One of the stories that the movie gets into, the documentary on the making of Apocalypse Now, is how Francis Coppola used helicopters from the Philippine Army because the United States Army wouldn't cooperate with the making of a movie about Vietnam. But the government kept wanting the helicopters back to fight a civil war against communist insurgents. Tell us some of the ways that kept disrupting the shooting of Apocalypse Now.
It was a very disruptive situation because the Army would send out their helicopters and whatever pilots they wanted to send out, and the pilots would be different every day, so they hadn't rehearsed. They didn't realize what it was like to fly in through filming situations, and they would sometimes they'd fly too high and they wouldn't be in the camera shot, or they just wouldn't realize what was involved in really performing for the camera, so to speak. So they would lose many shots because the pilots wouldn't be flying in the right place to be seen in the camera. And then the next day, by the time they finally learned how to do it, the next day they'd send different pilots. And then very frequently they would call the planes away. They'd be all set up for a shot. Everyone would be out there on the location shooting, and they would get some radio communication that that four of the helicopters had to leave for military reasons, or some days all of the helicopters, or some days they would be out there ready to work and expecting eight helicopters to be provided, and only two would show up. So it was a very difficult part of the production, and it cost tens and tens of thousands of dollars in lost footage and waiting for the helicopters to come that never came.
And there were guards at your house because Marcos was afraid that rebels would kidnap you and Francis Coppola for publicity?
Yes, they had some idea that if Francis would be kidnapped for some political reasons by the insurgents, that it would create an international incident and bring attention to the Philippines and unwanted attention, so that they provided us right from the beginning with guards, personal bodyguards, and it was very strange to live in a context where these bodyguards were around all the time, and I actually felt more concerned finally that the guards might cause some accident. They got very casual about their weapons. Our main bodyguard had just would stick his pistol in his belt of his blue jeans, and he'd get it out and show the kids how it worked, and he had a trunk full of shotguns and other, I don't know what, other guns and things in the trunk of the car. And it just seemed like I was really in more danger of some accident from the bodyguards than I really was in danger from insurgents.
I could see how that would not be very reassuring.
No, and I'm there with three children, and yeah. And in the casualness of the weapons that the guards had was really a concern to me.
Eleanor Coppola speaking to Terry Gross in 1992. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1992 interview with Eleanor Coppola. Hearts of Darkness, the documentary on Apocalypse Now for which she filmed and supplied footage, has just been released on DVD.
When Marlon Brando arrived on the set to play Kurtz, Francis Coppola didn't realize that Brando was going to be as heavy as he was. How did that affect the way the role was conceived?
Well, when Francis realized that he was not slimmed down and able to play the Green Beret that he was originally, committed to the part for, that Francis had to decide what to do in the situation. And his first idea was to play Marlon as an indulging, mango-eating, overindulging himself here in the jungle in this situation, and just play him sort of overweight and his uniform not really fitting properly, and just go with that whole kind of look. And Marlon did not want to do that. He just was unwilling to do that. So then Francis was really at a loss. What could he do then if he wouldn't do that? So the two of them sat down for days talking about what part he could play and how they could resolve this, the ending of this movie. And they at one point came up with this very theatrical, larger-than-life personage that's you see, you know, just emerging from the darkness and the light, and you never really fully see him in, as a reality. He's much more of a sort of an archetypical, you know, mythical figure. And that was sort of a new approach for Brando, because he was known for his great, you know, reality, the grittiness of his realness in his performances, so that he struggled with that too. And the two of them had a real head-to-head go there trying to resolve this, the ending of the film.
A lot of Marlon Brando's part was improvised. There's some really interesting footage in Hearts of Darkness of Brando improvising. Would you describe a little bit the process that, that he and Francis Coppola used to improvise the part?
Well, they would come up with some actual lines and some of the dialogue that Marlon was to say, but the way Marlon works is he has to find a reality, so he would then put those lines into kind of a just a sort of free form improvising and talking as he went along through the part. So they had definite points that he was supposed to make, and he then kind of created around those points and kind of gives it that that reality. Because one of the things he does, he, for instance, will like write a line on his hand or put it on a piece of tape on one of the props nearby, so that he sort of has to look for that line and sort of give it that little edge of struggle that, just like we have in our own conversation, I don't know exactly what line I'm going to say next, and it gives my, you know, voice a kind of edgy reality, because I'm sort of fishing for what the next line is going to be. And he does that. It's part of his technique to not learn his lines and just spit them out slickly, but to really just have to have that little edge of reaching for them.
It sounds from the footage you shot that one of the techniques that they'd use to improvise is that Francis Coppola would ask Marlon Brando questions off camera, and then Brando would have to respond to the questions, and the camera would be rolling as he responded.
Yes, that's right.
Why are we in Vietnam?
It's our time to grab this moment in history. It's our time to teach. Huh? I can't think of any more dialogue today.
Dennis Hopper played the part of a really drugged out American journalist in Vietnam. When he was cast in this role, he already had the reputation for being genuinely drugged out and burned out. And there's some terrific footage in the documentary of him and Francis Coppola talking together and trying to, like, work out what the part's going to be. And Coppola wants to know how come he doesn't know his lines yet. Why did Coppola even bring on Dennis Hopper? And I'm a really big fan of Hopper's asking this question, but he was in such bad shape then. You know, you wonder, why would you ask for this kind of trouble?
Well, I don't think Francis actually realized he was in that kind of shape. He thought he was a really good actor, and he had a lot of admiration for him, and he was cast in a role, a Green Beret role, and when he really got out there, Francis realized there's no way that he could play this the Green Beret, and he had to then sort of invent a part for him, because he thought he was very talented and there must be some way to use his gifts. And so Francis has the great ability to make the part fit the actor rather than the other way around. If the actor comes and can't play the part as written, he rewrites the part. And he certainly did that in Dennis's case, and tried to somehow utilize the character that he was, because that was one of the issues in the Vietnam War, is the use of drugs and the availability of drugs. And in fact, there in the Philippines, because of where we were there in Asia, there were drugs available and cheaply, and things that aren't available just here in while everybody's home in Los Angeles, so that there was experimentation on the among the people who were out there. And Dennis, of course, was just really far out at that moment. In fact, he looks back at that period and is pretty astounded himself, I think.
Why don't you say that to him in the scene?
Who?
Something clever like that. When he says, who are you? Why don't you say, who are you?
Because I haven't learned my lines yet.
I know, you've had them for 5 days.
The other thing I'd like to say is that...
These glasses,
I can't see anything through them. But, like, you know, every crack represents a life I've saved. You know what I mean? They represent a life I've saved.
All out in the scene.
I do, but you see, the director, you know, the director says, you don't know your lines. And then, like,
well,
you know,
if you know your lines, then you can forget them. Oh, you know more or less.
I see. But that's what I'm trying to do. Forget those lines.
No, but it's not fair to forget them if you never knew them.
During the making of Apocalypse Now, you sent your husband a telex, telling him he was becoming like Kurtz and creating his own Vietnam with a supply of wines and steaks and air conditioners. And you sent copies of this telex to the set designer, the cinematographer, and the production manager. Why did you do that? I mean, something must have really been working on you for you to not only telex Francis, but to telex the people who he worked with.
Well, at that moment, in my opinion, I was really concerned that the whole thing was going too far and had the potential of tipping over the edge. And that was just my response to the situation at that point in time. And now we're looking back at it, and so it doesn't seem so appropriate. But in the intensity of the moment, that was the moment where I just felt I had to speak out and give my opinion. And all throughout this project, it kept going, you know, closer and closer and closer to the edge, it seemed like. And in fact, I felt the forces and the pressure on Francis were so profound that I was very worried that he wouldn't be able to withstand all of those pressures. That was my one, you know, really deep and major concern, is that somehow it would just push him over the edge in some way. And in fact, he did collapse at one point and faint, and there was a moment where I was concerned, you know, that he might have a nervous breakdown or something, but he is a strong person, and after a couple of days, he was able to get his strength back and get his balance back and go on with the project and complete it. But there were some very scary moments there.
Eleanor Coppola speaking to Terry Gross in 1992. Hearts of Darkness, the documentary on Apocalypse Now for which he filmed and supplied footage, has just been released on DVD.
Every man has got a breaking point. You and I have them. Walt Kurtz has reached his. Very obviously, he has gone insane.
Yes, sir. Very much so, sir. Obviously insane.
Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews Juno. This is Fresh Air. The title character of the new comedy Juno is a high school student who gets pregnant after deciding to seduce her somewhat shy boyfriend. The film has gotten a lot of buzz, both for its controversial subject matter and the widely hailed performance by Ellen Page as Juno. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The best things in the new teen pregnancy comedy Juno are the animated credit sequence and the final shot of a girl and boy strumming guitars on the steps of a suburban house. There are grace notes in between, a lot of them. But sometimes a movie is so obnoxiously false from moment to moment that whatever its charms, it's hard to surrender to it. Those opening credits feature Juno, the heroine, transformed into a wiggly cartoon, the kind that uses real performers as a sort of baseline. The actress is Ellen Page, a magnetic young Canadian, and the filmmakers do an amazing job driving home the idea that this headstrong girl is her own universe. But in the next scene, she buys a pregnancy test from a snarky pharmacist, dips it in her urine in the store bathroom, and emerges ranting about the little plus sign that means it's positive. I know Juno doesn't care what people think. I know she's a poster girl for the MySpace generation, in which there's zero sphere of privacy. But her exhibitionism feels forced, even for her. It's a way for the writer, who goes by the name of Diablo Cody, and the director, Jason Reitman, to push the boundaries. They're nakedly eager to make the film a chick flick Rushmore or Garden State. They want teens to buy the soundtrack and seek out the videos and books and vintage Japanese comics the movie relentlessly references. They want to make them feel so in the know. So what's so bad about that? Nothing, if you don't mind the way the movie comes at you, with a soundtrack that rarely shuts up, and banter like bad Neil Simon with up-to-the-minute slang. In one memorably grisly scene, the pierced receptionist at an abortion clinic robotically goes through her supposedly empathetic spiel and then holds forth on the aroma of her boyfriend's penis. That makes Juno decide not to have that abortion, even though the boy who knocked her up, played by Superbad's Michael Cera, is a noncommittal cipher. Instead, she'll give the baby up for adoption. Her father, played by J.K. Simmons, accompanies her to the McMansion of a well-to-do couple, played by Jennifer Garner and Jason Bateman. And what a little Pop-Tart Juno is.
Hi, I'm Vanessa. You must be Juno, Mr. McGuff.
Hi.
Vanessa.
It's Vanessa, right? Is that...
Thanks for having me and my irresponsible child over to your house.
Oh, no, thank you. Thank you. Come on in. Can I take your coat or your hat?
Ah, yeah, sure, thanks.
A wicked pick in the Penny Saver, by the way. Super classy, not like those people with fake woods in the background. Honestly, who do they think they're fooling?
You found us in the Penny Saver?
Hi, Mark Loring. I'm the husband.
How you doing? Mac McGuff.
Nice to meet you. Hi.
This is Gerda Rouse, our attorney.
Gerda Rouse.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
And this, of course, is Juno.
Like the city in Alaska.
No.
No? Okay. Hun, should we sit down and get to know one another?
Oh, I thought I'd get some drinks. What would anyone like? I have Pellegrino or vitamin water or orange juice with folic acid.
All of them Maker's Mark, please.
She's kidding. Junebug has a wonderful sense of humor, just one of her many genetic gifts.
Juno does have an amusing conceit at its core. The teenage heroine is trying to seem smart and precocious, whereas the 30-ish would-be father, played by Bateman, is trying to stay a kid. And they meet in the middle, and it undermines his marriage. If only the dialogue weren't so cringeworthy, and if the jokes didn't disappear on cue at the end of every major segment when you're supposed to shed a little tear. Jason Reitman was mysteriously acclaimed for his ugly and inept adaptation of Christopher Buckley's Thank You for Smoking, but that movie didn't break out the way Juno will. It's already getting Oscar buzz, and it will certainly make Ellen Page a star. She has a gift for making her motor-mouth lines sound like they're really coming from her head, and an instinct for mixing almost supernatural self-possession with flashes of vulnerability. It's possible her Juno will even become a new archetype, a role model for teenage girls who've long craved their own Ferris Bueller. Brace yourself, folks, for the Juno generation.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hertzfeld. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now exhibiting sculptures by Martin Puryear. More at moma.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and health care of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a first-person account of how the Taliban is using fear and persuasion to expand its power in Afghanistan. We talk with Sarah Chase. She reported on the fall of the Taliban in 2001 for NPR. After that, she decided to stay and help rebuild the country. Join us for the next Fresh Air.